Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Power Is Now online radio. My name is Eric Frazier. Thank you for joining us today online and on the telephone. It's another beautiful day in Southern California and a great day to talk about alternative financing with women in default services. This is a live broadcast from the Mission Valley Resort in beautiful San Diego, California. Please tell your friends you're about to hear some great information about alternative financing and that they should join us online or by telephone right away. For those of you who are new to The Power Is Now online radio, the name and slogan The Power Is Now suggests that we maximize our potential for success in business and life when we act on information and opportunities now. The present is our future because the future is only a reflection of past decisions to act now. So what does that mean? It means that we are at our best and we maximize our success when we act now. That's our slogan, our theme, our mantra of The Power Is Now. The Power Is Now online radio is an online radio network from which a series of teleconferences are created to empower, inspire, and educate consumers and real estate professionals about changes in the world of real estate, banking, finance, marketing, economics, government, and anything else that can give real estate professionals and consumers the tools they need to be successful. For questions or comments about The Power Is Now, please email eric.frazier at thepowerisnow.com or contact me by telephone at 1-800-401-8994, extension 703. I appreciate the feedback and your suggested topics. If you are listening to this show for the first time, please go to thepowerisnow.com and become a member of the Power Is Now Network for free. And on the Power Is Now website and also on Blog Talk Radio, you can listen to past shows and take advantage of special discounts to other services that can help you grow your businesses, like property management, email marketing, virtual assistants, business and REO coaching, business and strategic planning, and power coaching. There is value in membership, and membership is free. Please go to thepowerisnow.com website and listen to The Power Is Now Breaking News with Bubba Mills as he breaks down the news for agents and default services, and Kate Holloman, who talks about news that affect women in real estate, finance, and the default space. And while you're on the website, check out the Power Is Now Agent Spotlight. In fact, the most recent interview was today with Darren Johnson, broker and owner of Johnson Premier Real Estate Company. Darren brings a wealth of experience as a HUD listing broker in two states and with many corporate clients as an REO broker. We have a special program airing on Blog Talk Radio and The Power Is Now with Bubba Mills and Corcoran Coaching that goes into detail about the REO Master and Quick Start program that starts in September, September 6th. It's called Put the Win in Your Sales with REO Masters and REO Quick Start. Every day you can hear that program at 2 p.m. There's a lot happening on The Power Is Now. Did you know between 500 and 600 agents listen to Bubba's show every day? Can you believe that? I recommend you listen to that program and you sign up for REO Quick Start and REO Coaching. When you add up all the listeners and all the shows that are playing on The Power Is Now, it's well over 2,000 agents tune in every single day to listen to the program. Last week, in fact, Jim Park, Vice Chair of REO, was on the show, and he talked about the upcoming conference with REO in Las Vegas. It's going to be at the Bellagio in Las Vegas, Nevada. Please listen to that show and learn more about what's happening in REO and why you should attend the conference. Well, folks, we're about ready to begin the Women in Default Services panel discussion about alternative financing. We're going to take a commercial break and give you an opportunity to tell your agents in the office to get online or on the phone and listen to these dynamic speakers. Call or email your friends and buddies in the business and let them know that WINS is live on the radio, and we're going to have a great program with valuable information that they can use. We'll be right back after this commercial break.
Hello, everybody. This is Bubba Mills, COO and Managing Partner of Corcoran Consulting and Coaching. Are you tired of going to conferences, being out of your office for 4 or 5 days, spending thousands of dollars? Well, we have the solution to your problem. Corcoran Consulting and Coaching has teamed up with the Powers Now to offer a special group coaching program to all Powers Now listeners. Starting on September 6th, we have the REO Quick Start. The REO Quick Start is for real estate agents that have sold 0 to 15 REO properties in any given year. This program is usually priced at $999. With the Power Is Now promo code, POWER, the price is only $949. It is a 9-week program, 1-hour call, no more than 40 agents per group. We're going to go over topics such as applying to be an REO agent, systems. We're going to help you register for REO and BPO companies, building relationships, and several more topics. For more details, you can listen to me on the Powers Now Radio, titled REO Masters and Quick Start, or you can go to our website at www.corcorancoaching.com for more details. We're also offering the REO Masters Group Coaching. This is for agents that sell 15 or more REO transactions per year. This program is usually priced at $14.99. With the Power code, all Powers Now listeners will be able to get this product at $13.99. Again, no more than 40 agents. There will be 3 different asset management companies also teaching one of the 12-week programs. This will also start on September 6th. It will go every Tuesday for 12 weeks. We're going to go over extensive BPO training, HUD, property preservation, scorecards, managing your asset management companies. I'm telling you, the details on this are phenomenal. Again, listen to me on the Powers Now Radio for more information or visit our website at www.corcorancoaching.com. You can also reach us at 1-800-957-8353. The power is now. Act now to change your future.
And we are back. And Bubba is absolutely right. If you are just joining us, this is a live event at the Mission Valley Resort in beautiful San Diego with the Women in Default Services, WINS. And we're about to have a panel discussion on alternative financing. Shelley, the founder and executive director of WINS, will be introducing our guests and the panel moderator in just a few minutes. This event would not be possible without the support of sponsorship. Today, our sponsors are Adam Sobeschio of Cutco, Eric Megan of Golden Opportunity Reverse Mortgage, Gary Grambling of Grambling Inspection and Consulting, and Georgia Barnett with Property ID, and Annette Turner with First Cal. We're going to have our sponsors introduce themselves to our audience in the same order I just mentioned. So first up is Adam Sobeschio, that is, Adam Sobeschio of Cutco. Welcome to the program, Adam.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. I'm sure all of you know at this point it's not an actual real estate event unless the nice guy makes an appearance at it, yes or yes. I say yes. I know there's nine. I can say yes. All right. Let's go ahead and do it this way. I know the room. We got a good room here. Raise your hand if you've heard of my product, my company, Cutco. Keep raising if you've ever ordered Cutco or if you've given out one of our gifts. Keep your hands raised. Look at how all those hands are still up. If your hand's not up yet, that's a problem. Don't worry. Get your hands up. If you haven't heard of Cutco, we've been around since 1949, our company. 8 years ago, I was born. We started our specialty division, Cutco Closing Gifts. We're the largest closing gift company in North America. Me in San Diego right now. I do gifts for over 1,500 realtors and lenders. This is a huge program, and what we do is we specialize in helping you all with your gifts. Most of you use me already, but if you're not using me, what's typically given to clients? You all have seen it, right? Gift baskets, gift cards, right? Dinner out, bottle of wine, plant, puppy, whatever, people. And I'm not here to say people don't like other gifts, because the reality is that people like all gifts, right? Who doesn't like a gift? It's free. If it's free, give it to me, I'll take it. We've just found that when you actually think about it logically, what happens to most gifts out there? Where are they 3 months later, right? 3 years later. They like it, then they eat it, they drink it, they spend it, it dies. Where's the gift, right? So we've done a Cutco. We found a way to help you brand your business with your gift. If you've been under a rock somewhere and not heard of Cutco, that's okay. We're kind of like the Rolls Royce, the Bentley. We're most comparable to Snap-on tools of kitchen knives and accessories because we're made in America. Yay. Guaranteed forever. Super high quality. What we do is we take our products and we engrave it. And we make over 100 products. Garden tools, barbecue, hunting, fishing, you name it. We engrave it with your guys' logo, name, and info right on the product itself. And I'm going to pass some of these around at the end. Listeners, just picture the most beautiful engraved knives that you've ever seen in your life. And that does a couple things for you. Anybody out here heard of Brian Buffini? Anybody go to his mastermind? It was great. I did Mastermind. I've done his 100 Days of Greatness. In there, he talked about how 80% of people would use the same exact realtor again if they could just remember their name. 80%. So all that really meant to me is that most people don't remember. When they see your name every single day on their favorite thing in the kitchen, what does that do for you? It creates top-of-mind awareness, right? This is not a business magnet card or a Padre calendar schedule, which has been sitting in the trash can since opening day. So what we do is we help you put something in there they're going to use every day. We also stick to the most used room in the house. Anybody in here know what the most used room in the house is?
The kitchen.
Kitchen, except for my house is bedroom, but that's a different presentation. So we put something in there they're going to see and use every day. There's other things that go along with this, too. This is the red. These are fully tax deductible. You're not limited to the IRS $25 gift write-off because they're branded. We also make it real easy by getting you a small supply of gifts. You don't have to worry about what to get people last minute. And we have a sharpening program that goes along with it also where we'll go out and service the client's knives every single year for free on your behalf. Most of my gifts are between $50 and $200. I guess since I'm on the radio, I'll give out my cell phone number. If you're in the United States or Canada, you can call me 760-310-6714 or email me info@cutcoadam.com. Pretty easy there. And we'll get you some info. Again, these are the best-selling closing gifts in the United States and Canada. If you want info, call me. If you're here, which you are, if you're looking at me, give me your business card if you want info. And if you have a closing coming up in the next 30 days, star your business card. We'll get you info. Sorry for going over my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. And next up is Gary from Grambling of Grambling Inspections and Consulting. Thank you, Gary.
Well, and thank you. And just like Cutco, I was also born in the United States. And what I do is I offer home inspection services, real estate consulting, construction consulting. I do not compete with brokers. I don't do real estate brokerage. But what I do is I give you, once again, going back to Cutco, I give you one of the sharpest inspections you're ever going to get. And my background includes starting out in real estate property management, moving into land development. My construction company, as a general contractor, I've constructed literally a couple of hundred homes here in Southern California. And I've done over 1,000 home inspections since I started focusing just on home inspections. So if you're looking for a good home inspection and a good home inspector, call me, 760-455-4978. And if you don't want a good one, then call someone else.
Okay, great. Next up is Georgia Barnett with Property ID.
Thank you very much. Hi, Georgia. I am the North County rep for Property ID in San Diego County. We do have one other rep named Cynthia Marquez who could not be here with us today, but we are the natural hazard disclosure industry leader. We've been in business for over 15 years. In California, it's a mandated report. The three big disclosures are earthquake, fire, and flood, and we always like to recommend when you get your listing, please order your NHD from Property ID. Read our summary page. If there's any red flags for your client, we have free attorney assistance that can answer any questions on behalf of you or your client. We also offer free updates on our report. We do understand that properties can be out there for quite some time, so please take advantage of that. If your property's been out there for 6 months or more, call us and we'll give you a free update. We always want you to have your information up front for your client, so like I said, when you get a listing, order that report, and then there's nothing, no red flags down the line for you. We also have additionally insured insurance. No deductible. We have our own in-house attorneys that will go to bat for you because it is, you know, 2 years from date of disclosure when somebody can file a report on that. So please order a report from Property ID. This is all we do. We are based out of California, only in California. Our corporate office is located on Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. So if you have a complaint, a question, a query, a concern, you're going to call and you're going to speak to an actual customer representative right there on Wilshire Boulevard. So please take advantage of all of the free services we offer you. And then also, as far as the bank-owned properties, we do know the price points for all the asset managers and banks out there. So just please mention that it's a, for example, Wells Fargo-owned property, and we match that price point for you. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Next up is Annette Turner with First Cal.
Good afternoon. My name is Annette Turner, and I have been working with First Cal for just a few months. I've been in the industry for 21 years. I started off processing and then went into underwriting a little bit, then branched off into mortgage origination about 12 years ago, and I haven't stopped. And I keep asking myself, why am I in this cycle? Why am I in this cycle? But I must love the adrenaline and the drama and the learning. There's constant learning involved with what we do. But I just want to let you know that we carry the normal suite of lending, government loans, VA, FHA. I love lending on government loans. There's just so many phenomenal opportunities to meet great people among the borrowers. Just everyone, you have to work together so well as a team. I enjoy that about my purchases. I also do a lot of conventional lending as well. It's just a never-ending adventure. I just look forward to being here, learning a lot this afternoon from the speakers, and thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, and that's a list of our sponsors. Again, we have Adam Sabesco with Cutco, Gary Grambling of Grambling Inspection and Consulting, Georgia Barnett with Property ID, and Annette Turner of First Cal. These are the sponsors of today's event entitled Alternative Financing, and this is a panel discussion. And so we're going to take a break and get ready for the panel. And next up will be Shelley Kay. Shelley will come and talk to us in a few minutes and introduce our speakers. In the meantime, take this opportunity to reach out to your fellow agents in the office, email your friends, text message, get on Facebook, let them know that The Power Is Now is online right now, and you can hear some great information from CPAs, attorneys, escrow officers, reverse loan officers, information about 1031 exchange, and even private money. This is going to be a great seminar. I encourage you all to tune in and then get everyone involved so they too can take advantage of this wonderful opportunity. So we'll be right back in about a couple of minutes here, right here on the Power Is Now online radio. And we're back. Thank you for joining us today on the Power Is Now online radio. And for those of you who are tuning in just now, we are in San Diego. This is a live event at the Mission Valley Resort in San Diego, California. And this event is sponsored by Women in Default Services. And we're live here conducting a panel discussion on alternative financing. And now the founder and executive founder and executive manager, if you will, of WIN is Shelley Kay. Folks, Shelley Kay.
I want to welcome everybody and welcome our sponsors, our speakers, and Vicki for planning this event and for everybody attending. And also to let you know that WINS is very excited that Eric has been able to stream our show live. so that we can accommodate all of our members all across the country. And for those folks that hopefully will be potential members or just listen in on our webinars and our activities, WINS is an association by, for, and about women in the default services. However, most of our events are open to both men and women. We do mentor, network, provide education and business opportunities for our members. And if anyone would like to find out more about WINS, please go to our website, www.womeninds.com, or give me a call at 949-734-3466. I always love speaking about WINS, and I'd be more than happy to talk to you. We have some fabulous webinars coming up for our WINS members. On August 28th, USA Cares, How to Become a Certified Military Housing Specialist. WINS is putting that seminar on, or that webinar, and that's going to be a two-hour webinar, and our members will get certified. On August 30th, we're presenting Don Maxwell from 24 Asset Management and Realty Prox. Realty Prox is a short sale platform, and WINS members that are on the call will be entered into a special drawing for a lunch with Don Maxwell during the Five Star Conference. So WINS has lots of activities, lots of networking, and if you're going to be at the Five Star Conference, please visit us at booth 240. And now I'd like to introduce our moderator, Becky Aring from Elite Escrow Services in San Diego. Welcome, Becky.
Thank you, Shelley. I'm really excited about today. I'm an old bird that actually started in the business when I was in high school in the 70s. And some of the programs we're going to talk about today were popular back when the rates were really high. Obviously, things have changed a little bit since then. The reasons people might want to do some of these alternative financing programs has changed as well. But we have an amazing panel here that is going to bring you a lot of different angles on these different things, and by all means, feel free to ask questions of them because they are the resident experts. I'm going to start by introducing Eric Meehan of Golden Opportunity Reverse. I've known Eric for a few years now, and he's a broker owner of his company, and he started back in 06. And I know he does great service because I've actually used him with my own family members, and thank you very much. Okay, next I want to introduce Gina Engelstad down at the end there. Love and adore this woman. She actually is my boss, so thank you for my job. But Gina has been in the business since the 70s as well, and she not only is the manager of the office, she is an escrow officer herself, but she's very involved with the escrow association and the escrow institution. So thank you for being here, and I know that you're going to bring a lot of wisdom and wit to all of this. Okay, I'm going to introduce Susan Lamson. She's with Kimball, is it Tyree?
Tyree.
I knew I'd say it wrong. Kimball, Tyree, and St. John here in Mission Valley. She's been in the business for 25 years, and her emphasis has been in presenting developers in acquisition and disposition transactions, complex leasing transactions, land use matters, representing mortgage bankers, and advising owners of small and medium-sized businesses. Sasha, to my right here, Sasha Fev-Lucas has been involved in the mortgage industry since 2002. And 2005, he was a business partner that started a company here in La Mesa, but he had the insight to see that things were kind of changing, and in 2007, he decided to make some other changes and move to San Francisco, where he started doing subprime. That has now been his focus. I see him around a lot. He's well-received by investors and people in the industry who know that that he's got it going on and knows what he's talking about. So now I want to introduce Kathy Bowinga back here in the back. She's going to be our first speaker. She is with Asset Preservation, Inc., and she has been in the business for 30 years. She brings a wealth of knowledge, like 500 accredited seminars that she's done. So be prepared to learn a lot from her presentation. Let's see here. Who do I have left? Mike Batson. Mike Batson is our CPA. He's my CPA, too. He's the only guy I know that can give you bad news and make you laugh at the same time. So I hope he makes us laugh today. Okay, Debbie Funderburk. She is a broker owner, been in business for 22 years here in San Diego. She covers San Diego and South Riverside. She has been very strongly involved with REO business, but has also been involved with property management. So she's got a lot of experience in commercial and residential. So I think, Billy, could I introduce everybody? I kind of went out of order there. Okay, I'm going to turn this over to Kathy. Could you help me get her presentation? Kathy, welcome.
Stage. If you would like to ask a question, please press 1 on your touch-tone dial, and we'll bring you on to ask a question. Be sure to state your name and the state you're calling from, and we'll be happy to bring you right on the line and ask a question of any one of the panelists. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Kathy Bowinga. I'm with a company called Asset Preservation. We're a national qualified intermediary. We do 1031 delayed and reverse exchanges throughout the country. I have been in the business over 35 years, so I've been in the business many, many years, and I'm very happy to be here to talk about something I'm pretty passionate about. When it comes to alternate financing, I said, why did you want a 1031 exchange company? But you know what? The more I thought about it, I thought Section 1031 is probably the best reinvestment plan there is out there, and it should be in every investor's toolkit. So I think you'll have a lot of information presented to you today. You can always go to our website, look up a lot of this information, but I think it'll give you some good ideas. If you leave here with anything today, I hope it's you'll have at least a thought that maybe if you're an investor, you need to really think about where you're going to be 5 or 10 years from now, because things are changing. What is a 1031 exchange? It is the most powerful tool that you can have in your investment toolkit. It's a reinvestment play in that it allows an investor who owns investment property to sell their property, defer paying their capital gains. It's not free, but it is deferred, and take all their equity and use it to purchase replacement property of like kind using some very specific rules. It's probably the most powerful thing right now because we're in a low interest rate environment. If you have cash, you're credit worthy, you can take that equity, move forward into an equal or greater property with better cash flow. You can diversify. There are so many things you can do in this fantastic market. I've been in the market, like I said, over 35 years. I've been through 3 cycles. All of you know investors love to buy low and sell high. I've never seen interest rates as low as they are right now, so being able to sell, use that equity, purchase replacement property at these low interest rates, and improve your financial plan, your estate plan, find properties with better cash flows, I think it's a wonderful opportunity. Section 1031 has been around since 1918. People don't realize it's had a lot of different names, but it's a lot of words. It says, no gain or loss shall be recognized in the exchange of property held for productive use in trade, business, or investment. If such property is exchanged solely for property of like kind, which is to be held either for productive use in trade or business or for investments. A lot of words. But basically what that says is if you own investment property, you hold it as investment, and you sell it, you can defer your capital gains following some very specific rules and purchase a property of like kind following those specific rules and defer your capital gains tax. What you do is you carry over your basis and you carry over your depreciation schedule from the property you're selling to the property that you're purchasing. There are some exceptions to this rule, and I do want to talk about those. And that one rule in a 1031 exchange that seems to be, I think, very common right now, we have a lot of people out there that are flipping properties that are basically dealers in the eyes of the IRS. They're purchasing properties that are of great value. They're fixing them up and reselling them. The first exception to Section 1031 does say that if you were a dealer or reseller of property, you cannot do a 1031 exchange. Okay? So you need to know that. And the fourth exception here I think is very important to note, and that is if you have interest in a partnership or a multi-member LLC, A golden rule in a 1031 exchange, if you hold investment property as the same taxable entity that sells, must be the same taxable entity that purchases the replacement property. If you're in a partnership or a multi-member LLC, your interests in those partnerships or multi-member LLCs are considered personal property, and you cannot exchange your interest. So that means a partnership owns a property, it buys a replacement property as a partnership, or it owns it as a multi-member LLC, it buys as an LLC. So that's a very important an issue, because a lot of people buy properties with partners or other members in LLCs, and I recommend anytime you buy an investment property, you consider your exit strategy and make sure that the entity in which you hold the property is really the entity you want when 5 or 10 years from now you want to sell it. So make sure you check some of these issues out before you buy investment property. In 2012, many investors have had choices. One, they can hold the property. They want to wait for the market to come back, or they want to sell it. And they sell it, and they want to defer their capital gains tax, or maybe not. Right now, long-term capital gains is at 15%. California state tax is at 9.3%. And there is an ugly 25% recapture depreciation for owners that sell and want to pay the tax, which is a lot of money. But I will tell you, there are CPAs and some people that say, well, maybe I better sell now because long-term capital gains is only at 15%. In my lifetime, I've had capital gains rates that have been federal up to 40%. So 15% is quite low. So everyone has a choice. Or they can do an exchange, and that is they can defer paying the capital gains and take all that equity and buy a property of like kind and use Section 1031. I just want to go through this quickly so some of the people in our audience have an idea of how you calculate capital gains and what it actually means. When you buy a piece of investment property, we're not talking about your primary residence here, okay? We're not talking about your second home. We're talking about property that's held for investment. When you buy it, you have an original basis. And over time, that basis goes up because you put in capital improvements, and it goes down because you've taken depreciation. I have an example here where I bought a property for $500,000 10 years ago. I put on a new roof for $50,000. Over that 10-year period, I've depreciated for $150,000, or basically $15,000 a year. So my net adjusted basis is $400,000. I'm now going to sell it for $1,200,000. I've done pretty well. I want to calculate my gain. I take $1,200,000 and I subtract my net adjusted basis, then my closing costs, escrow and title, etc. My capital gains is $720,000. Please note, the loan amount has nothing to do with the capital gains. Everyone says to me when they call me, well, I put this much money down and I have this much that I owe on the property. It has nothing to do with how you calculate capital gain. I have $720,000 of capital gain. Now I will calculate the tax due. I will pay 25% back on the depreciation I've taken over that 10-year period, which is $37,500. I'll pay federal capital gains at 15%, which is $85,500. And then state in California is 3.3. I'll pay $66,960. I'm going to pay $189,000 plus in tax. Everyone has a choice. You can want to pay that tax, and you can do that. Here's an example where we have the closing, get the after-tax equity. I'm selling for $1,200,000. I take out my closing cost of $80,000. I take up my loan, which I did have a loan for $300,000. To get my gross equity of $820,000. Then I can pay the capital gains tax, and I'm left over with after-tax equity of $630,000. In this example on analysis number 5, I've paid the tax. I have $639,000 left over. If I put that as 35% down, I could buy a property worth $1,800,000, okay? Or in analysis number 6, I could actually take all my gross equity, the $820,000, I could put that as 35% down, and I could buy a property worth $2,342,000. This is an example of the power of exchange, but because what you're doing is you're deferring paying that those taxes, and in doing so, you have more equity and more power to leverage and buy larger properties, and this is what people and investors have been doing for years. Next year, there are people out there concerned about what's going to happen, and I think our CPA will talk about it. I don't know. But right now, if the Bush air tax rate ends at the end of the year and that does not change, next year capital gains will go up to 20%. We do have a new 3.8% Medicare tax, which may go into effect, which affects joint filers with a modified adjusted gross income of $250,000 or for single over $200,000, which I think is probably going to affect just about everyone because it includes so much. It includes capital gains, dividend, wages, royalties. It includes so much. Capital gains from your primary residence, investment property, second homes. So I think touching base with your CPA is probably a good idea in the future. But who knows what's in that crystal ball. Intent to hold for investment. Whenever you're an investor doing an exchange, your intent must be to hold for investment. People ask me, how long do I have to hold the property to prove that it's held for investment? There's nothing in Section 1031, nothing. It's really facts and circumstances based. There is a private letter ruling in 1984, which says 2 years. But there have been two recent cases, Goolsbee versus the commissioner and Reesink versus the commissioner, where it's been very clear that the IRS looks at facts and circumstances as well. Time is one issue. And facts and circumstances. More aggressive practitioners say at least hold it for 1 year so that you're in long-term capital gains and you straddle two tax filing periods. In a 1031 exchange, there's things that you have to remember. Another golden rule is you need to reinvest all your net exchange proceeds and also acquire a property of equal or greater debt. I have an example here where I'm selling a property for $900,000. I'm going to buy one for $1,200,000. As you see here, I'm actually going up in debt. I'm taking all my net equity, putting it into the replacement property, and I have a 100% tax-deferred exchange. You can, as a strategy, have what's called boot. You can go down in value. There's nothing that says you can't do that. Here's an example where I went from the $900,000 that I was selling, and I only purchased a property for $700,000. What happens is I went down in debt. I had mortgage relief of $40,000. I also took some cash out, $100,000, which is cash boot. And in this particular case, I will pay tax on the $140,000, which is not like-kind to the extent that I have a recognized gain. What I find right now is many investors have rollover losses that are covering some of the gain that they're taking. Passive losses and passive gains wash each other out. So I recommend that anytime you are doing a 1031 exchange, you do talk to your tax and legal advisors. I am not licensed to give tax or legal advice, and all of you have very specific situations that are unique to you. So making sure that your tax and legal advisor is consulted, I think, is real important. Quickly, there are a few very important rules. The taxpayer, the seller of the property, cannot have constructed or actual receipt of his funds at the time of closing. That's critical. The taxpayer here is the exchanger. He has a total of 180 days in which to purchase his replacement property after he closes. Day zero here is the date that he closes. 180 days isn't so bad, but 45 days is a little difficult. There is a 45-day identification period. The taxpayer must have an exchange agreement in place with a qualified intermediary or an independent third party that's going to hold his funds during the exchange period. I call it the kiss of death. Don't close escrow on a transaction if you do not have an exchange agreement in place prior to close. If you close and you do not have that agreement in place, you will have a taxable event, so be very, very careful. The 45th day is probably the most critical day in the timeline in that on the 45th day, you must identify the property or properties you're going to purchase in the remaining 135 days. There are three rules that you must comply with. The first is the three property rule. You have to identify one, two, or maximum three properties that can be of any fair market value. But what happens if you find five properties you want to buy? Because a lot of people are doing multi-property transactions. They're selling one and buying multiple properties. You can default to the second rule, which is the 200% rule, which says you can purchase or identify, excuse me, as many properties as you would like, but you cannot exceed double the value of the property you sold. So if I sell a property for $1.2 million, I can identify as many properties as I want, but their aggregate fair market value cannot exceed $2,400,000. I have an exchange that I just completed. The people identified 47 properties on the 45th day and bought 31 in the remaining 135 days in a multi-property exchange. That's the largest I've ever done, but there are many of them doing this. And this particular family bought properties all over the country, and it was quite a successful transaction. They increased their cash flow by 258%. Okay, so that's the basic timeline. You can always go to our website, apiexchange.com, or call me to get more information on the subject. Here's the timeline. I talked about the 45 days, 180 day exchange period, the three property 200% rule, or there is a third rule, which is the 95% rule, which says you can identify any number of properties, but you must purchase 95% of the aggregate fair market value of those properties, which is pretty hard to do. So the 95% rule is used one in thousands, so it's not very common. But the three-property rule and the 200% rule are extremely common and used all the time. Identification has to be in writing, unambiguously described, hand-delivered or mailed to the person holding the funds. The 45-day identification is critical because if you do not identify on the 45th day, your transaction is over. You then, on the 46th day, get your money and you have a taxable event. If you identify on the 45th day, you have the remaining 135 days to close. Okay. I do want to talk about seller carryback financing. It's a financing tool. Investors a lot of times don't know that they own a property free and clear, and I have an example. I have a couple who owns a large industrial building in North County, San Diego. It had been vacant for years, and they've had a lot of people looking at it, but it's been empty for over a year. And they had people coming to them, and they decided they wanted to make it presented in a way where it would benefit them in many different facets. What they did is they told the buyer that they would allow the buyer to only put 10% down and they would carry paper back. So they are going to carry a note back. And in a 1031 exchange, you can do one of two things. You can not include that note in the 1031 exchange, and then it becomes an installment sale under Section 453. And you pay every year the principal is paid down on that note. You pay a little capital gains over time. Or you can include that note in the exchange. They are going to include that note in the exchange. So we are going to be, asset preservation, the qualified intermediary is going to be the beneficiary on that note. They are going to purchase that note from us and replace that note with their own cash. So they're going to buy, we're going to go and close. They're going to take paper back. We're going to be the qualified intermediary that's on the note. They're going to buy that note from us in the exchange and replace it with their own cash so that they can then, in the exchange, take all the cash, and they're going to buy three apartment buildings with that, and they're now going to have a note. It's not an installment sale anymore, and they have a note on a property that they love. And the owner said to me, you know, they put 10% down, but that money that we had in the bank, I'm getting a better rate on this note than I would keeping that money in the bank. And if I have to take the property back, I don't care because we really do like this property. And we think in 5 or 10 years the property is going to be worth a lot more. So seller carryback financing is a great tool. The exchanger can purchase the note, which they're doing. They can use the note towards a down payment on a replacement property. They can even have someone pay off the note, the buyer can pay off the note during the exchange period. So seller carryback financing is possible. There are also it's a trend right now for people who are in foreclosure. We have seen some people go into foreclosure, and if you know someone that is losing their home in foreclosure in a deed in lieu, there is a possibility that they could do a 1031 exchange because they may lose their property, but they may have tax to pay. And there are some options. They can check that out on our website. I do want to bring up a potential pitfall in REOs and short sales, and that is in a 1031 exchange. If you are a seller in a 1031 exchange and looking to buy short sellers or REOs, be very cautious. In a short sale, are you going to close in 180 days? Not always. Can you close in 180 days? And two, in REOs, we found a lot of lenders are out there, and they don't allow assignable purchase contracts. In a 1031 exchange, you must have an assignable purchase contract. Some lenders and services are specifically stating that the purchase contract is not assignable, so be careful. Potential opportunities, I just told you, buying multiple properties is out there. You can also do what's called a reverse exchange. You can take advantage of a revenue procedure 2000-37 that allows you to go out and purchase a replacement property first and then take 180 days to sell your relinquished. It's a huge opportunity. There are improvement exchanges and personal property exchanges. So there are other opportunities. Due diligence. Make sure that you always look at the qualified intermediary because we're holding your money. We're like your bank. And you really need to ask some questions in the state of California. We are somewhat regulated. We have to have bonding E&O insurance. But ask, in whose name are the funds being held? What are the requirements for deposits and withdrawal? Ask if they're part of a major company. What is the financial strength? What is the security mechanism? Asset Preservation is a wholly owned subsidiary of Stewart Title. We do have E&O insurance. We're bonded. We're audited twice a year by KPMG. We're one of the largest in the U.S. and have some of the greatest financial strength of any company in our business. So I feel very proud to be working for this company. Okay. If any of you have any questions, please let me know. I talked about this subject very briefly. I speak on it 18 hours. So I really want to thank you all for listening, and I hope all of you can become happy investors and have a plan and succeed in that plan in 5 or 10 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kathy. I've already got a question written down for one of our panelists when we get around to picking on them. Okay, I'm going to be bringing up Eric Meehan now, and he is going to talk to us about how seniors can use a reverse mortgage to actually purchase a property and what kind of scenarios might be a really good fit for one of your clients or perhaps your client's parents.
Thank you, everybody. Eric Meehan with Golden Opportunity Reverse Mortgage. Briefly, I got in the reverse mortgage business about 4 years ago. I was doing regular loans, forward loans, conventional loans. And my mom called me up one day and asked me, she saw a commercial with Robert Wagner, one of her favorite actors, that I'm sure everybody has seen, about this new reverse mortgage thing that had been around for about 20 years already. And what did I know about it? I didn't know anything about it. And So I decided to look into it and see what it was all about, and I just fell in love with the product. Unfortunately, my parents didn't have enough equity to do a reverse mortgage, but I just fell in love with the product and how it could help so many people and so many seniors like my parents. And my motto became, I treat everybody like my parents, and I like my parents. So that's how I got into the reverse mortgage business. So here I'm going to talk about a little bit about reverse mortgages and how real estate agents can use these to help people purchase homes. What is a reverse mortgage? A reverse mortgage is a type of loan that provides homeowners age 62 or older with the option of turning their own home equity into cash to pay off debt, increase monthly income, provide financial stability while still living in it and owning their own home. Reverse mortgages that conform to FHA guidelines are also known as HECMs, home equity conversion mortgages. who's eligible for a reverse mortgage? Anyone that is 62 or older and owns their own home. It has to be owner-occupied. Has enough equity in the home to pay off all existing liens. They generally need about 40% of equity in the home. And a home must fall under FHA guidelines because this is an FHA loan. The types of homes that are eligible. Single-family residences, FHA-approved condominiums. This is very important, as a lot of condominiums, unfortunately, have fallen out of being FHA-approved. So that's something you definitely need to be aware of. 1 to 4 unit buildings, as long as one of the borrowers lives in one of the units. That's a very big advantage. Manufactured homes, if they fall under FHA guidelines, they must be on a permanent foundation, and you must own the land that they sit on. The value limit, this is very important too. The maximum home value limit given to any home using a reverse mortgage is $625,500. That's the cap. Even if a home is worth $800,000, the most they'll give, the value they'll use, is $625,500. This means, like I said, this means regardless if the home is worth more, the monetary calculations are used on this amount. If the home is valued less, obviously they'll use that, the value that it was given. Now, a purchase example. Mr. and Mrs. Jones are both 62 and have recently sold their home 30 years because their children moved out and it became too much to keep up with. They're both retired and they wanted a smaller home with newer updates and easy to care for. So they found this home in Rancho Bernardo, which is a beautiful community here in San Diego, for $450,000. Now, using a normal conventional type of loan purchase, they'd normally put down about 20%, which is $90,000. So they would need a loan of $360,000. With a 30-year fixed rate of about 4%, that'd be about $1,780 a month payment, plus taxes and insurance. So the monthly payment would be an estimated $2,286. Now, to qualify for that loan, they would need credit scores of about 680 or better and a debt-to-income ratio of 40% or lower, assuming they didn't have any other monthly bills, such as car payments or credit cards, which most likely they would have to have a combined monthly income of roughly $5,716 that can be documented, income statements, asset statements, bank statements, all of these things. I know now that may be kind of tough, especially for retired people. They may not have that kind of money as an income. Using a reverse mortgage, I'll show you how simple it is that they could get into that same house. Same scenario, using the same loan, purchase of the $450,000. They're both 68. They would be required to put down 37%, or $168,000. That's only 17% more than they would normally under the 20%. If you amortize that, they're just making probably about 2 years extra payments up front, but they would never have payments after that. There's no minimum credit score needed. There's no minimum debt-to-income ratio requirement. There's no minimum monthly income needed. None of that is needed because there's no monthly payment with a reverse mortgage. All that is required is to verify the funds that they would be getting for their down payment, which most likely came from probably the sale of their recent home. They're still required to pay the property taxes and homeowners insurance like they normally would. And at this time, the lenders do not impound, so they would be required to pay those on their own. So what are the advantages of using a reverse mortgage to purchase a home? No credit score requirement. Bad credit, no problem, even if they've had a foreclosure in their past. No income requirement. No income documentation. No job, which hopefully if they're retired, they wouldn't. No problem. No DTI. Don't have to worry about what their income is versus what the cash is going out. No asset requirement. No worrying about whether borrowers will even get approved for a loan. For the real estate agents, that's huge, especially if you're dealing with senior citizens because they may have problems documenting their income. I know a lot of real estate agents, they're always sweating out on whether or not their borrowers or their buyers are going to get approved. These can close in 30 days or less. I've done numerous reverse mortgage purchases. The quickest I did was just about 3 months ago. The gentleman himself was a real estate agent. From the time that we submitted the paperwork till we funded the deal, it was 2.5 weeks. What does that mean? You get paid quicker. So it's a great alternative for real estate agents when they're dealing with senior citizens. So here's a couple of reverse mortgage purchase scenarios. an elderly mom might be moving here to be near her family, but still wants to be independent without financial obligations. Maybe their children don't want her living with them as well. Seniors buying down and pocketing excess bags. I know a lot of people say, well, they're going to pay cash for it. They have $450,000. But why? Why put down all that money when all they need to put down is $168,000, and then they have the rest of that money as a nest egg to use to have a healthy and wonderful rest of their life? Seniors sometimes are in poor health. They might be going from a two-story to a one-story, and they might not have normally be able to qualify for a loan. Here's some of the myths regarding a reverse mortgage. I've heard them all, so I'm sure that you probably sitting there thinking or out there on TV or radio thinking about, well, I've heard this and I've heard that. Myth one, if I take out a reverse mortgage, the lender will own my own home. Wrong. Homeowners remain on title. They keep their ownership for the life of their loan, and they can choose to sell the home at any time. As long as the home is maintained and the property taxes and homeowners insurance is paid, they cannot be called due. Myth, my children will be responsible for the repayment of the loan. Wrong, the reverse mortgage are non-recourse loans. This means the property is sold to pay the loan when the homeowner passes away or decides to leave the home. There's no mortgage debt for the family and their heirs to repay. Only low-income seniors get reverse mortgages. This is another myth. I've done several recently with reverse mortgages for people who were actually quite liquid, but they just decided they wanted to keep the money that they had in their investments and use the equity in their home instead. If I outlive my life expectancy, this is a big one, the lender will evict me. Wrong. You can never be kicked out of your home, no matter whether or not the property value goes below the loan value. As long as you're paying your taxes and insurance and you're keeping the property up, you'll never get kicked out. If you have any questions, I know a lot of you are out there across the country, but if you don't have a reverse mortgage lender, please feel free to call me. I have lots of relationships across the country that I can help anybody. Please give me a call, 858-225-6292, or give me an email. Thanks, everybody.
Eric, I want to ask you a question. You mentioned the loan limits. Is that a nationwide loan limit, or is that just a California? I want to specify that since we've got people all over the nation listening.
That is a nationwide loan limit. There are some available jumbo limits, but the loan-to-value is much lower than on this HECM government loan.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Have a question.
Oh.
Mr. Mead, is there a maximum amount of equity you can borrow out of the home? If you own the home, can you borrow up to 80% of the equity if you've got it, own it free and clear, or what's the...
Well, the maximum, it's the great thing about it, because there's no credit score in any of those statements. It really is just the value of the home up to the 625-500 limit, and then their age. They use a life expectancy much like life insurance. The older you are, the higher the loan-to-value will go. Roughly at 62, which is when you're first eligible, you need about 40%, so you'd be eligible for about 60% loan-to-value. The older you go, I just did one. The woman was 82 years old. The house was valued at $725,000. She got $460,000 out. If you own it free and clear, this is getting beyond the purchase, but just in reverse mortgages in general, you can take it out in lump sum, you can take it out in monthly income, you can have a line of credit where you can pull it out whenever you want it as a safety net. So there's a lot of different ways that these can be used.
Okay. It's my pleasure to bring up Mike Batson, my happy CPA from Sharp, Sundstrom & Batson, and I'm sure we're going to be very entertained. No pressure.
While we're waiting for the presentation, I wanted to remind each of our speakers to speak directly into the mic so that their presentation comes out clearly over Blog Talk Radio. Again, for those of you on Blog Talk Radio, if you have any questions, press 1 on your phone, and we'll bring you online to ask questions of the speaker.
Well, while Sasha's helping me get that loaded, I want to talk about the deductibility of financing the interest that you have on personal residences and rental properties. And I'm going to start with telling a story. And hopefully by the time I'm done with the story, Sasha's got me all hooked up here. Had a furlough of a client about 2 years ago. And here we go. And this couple came to me. They had done a 2007 tax return. Thank you, Sasha. 2007 tax return. And they had gotten audited by the IRS. The IRS did not like the deduction of the Schedule A for the mortgage interest on Schedule A. And they threw it all out. And they went back to their tax preparer and said, "We're being audited. What are we going to do?" And he said, "Oh, I know what to do. I'll go ahead and resubmit a form." And they sent it in. It was rejected. They still owed the full amount of the $28,000 is what they were asking for. And tried it again with an amended return, and that got hung up. And then after that, they never heard from their tax preparer again. So they came to me, took a look at it, and we figured out what the problem was. Not all interest is created equal. The IRS has certain rules and restrictions about how to deduct interest. And fortunately, the story ended well. We were able to get things sorted out with the IRS. They didn't have to pay the $28,000. It was only about $2,000 or $3,000, and they're in business. All right. Accountants love numbers, so you can see in my presentation I'm talking about Section 163 of the Internal Revenue Code. I just threw that in there because I'm an accountant. 163, what a beautiful number that is, isn't it? That code section basically says you can deduct all interest except for personal interest. And so you'd think that you'd look down the code and say, well, what's personal interest? Well, personal interest is everything except, and it gives you a laundry list of all these different types of interest. The five most common ones I've put there, a trade or business, investment interest, you can borrow on margin to buy stocks or other types of investments that you might have, like raw land, for example. Qualified residence interest, which is your typical mortgage interest on your Schedule A. A passive activity, which would be rental properties, is one of the passive activities out there. And then student loans, educational interest. So I wanted to talk about the residence first and how we deduct that and what limitations are on these residence loans. You're allowed to have a mortgage of $1 million and deduct all of the interest on that mortgage up to $1 million. If you refinance that mortgage, that new mortgage, that interest, you get a better rate, let's say, you can still deduct that as well. Loans that are used for the construction of your home, those also work. If you're adding on, if you're improving it, that kind of debt is considered acquisition debt, which goes on Schedule A again as a mortgage interest deduction. There's some caveats. The problem that my client had, when they acquired their property, their residence, they needed a down payment, and they didn't have the cash to do it, but they had two rental properties. One of them had quite a bit of equity. The lender said, well, if you can get a down payment on that, borrow from somebody else on that rental property and throw it down onto this house, then we'll close the deal and you can buy the home. Well, that property, the rental property, the money they received from the rental property is not secured by the residence they were living in. When the IRS questioned that, they denied the deduction because you have to secure the note with the property that you were living in, in your residence. And that's why they did end up owing a couple $1,000s on that, because that down payment that came from that rental property was not allowed. So you have to make sure that the debt is secured by the residence. Now, a lot of people in the past, when they used to have equity in their home, hopefully that's growing in some other parts of the country, and I think we're starting to get a little bit of traction in San Diego, you could have a second mortgage or a HELOC for up to $100,000, and you could use that money for anything under the sun. I bought a boat a few years ago. I've since sold it. But I deducted the interest on that sucker, and I was pretty happy with myself. You can use for anything you want. It doesn't have to be used in improvements on the property. But what you have to be careful of is if you borrowed on that property, let's say it was 4 or 5 years ago, and you have this HELOC or this second, and now the value of your property has gone down, this is a home equity loan. This deduction comes because you have equity. If the fair market value has come down and you no longer have equity, you are upside down, you're not to deduct that interest. Now, it's kind of hard for the IRS to follow that. People don't understand that. Sometimes that gets lost, and the tax preparer just goes ahead and keeps doing what he's been doing the last 3 or 4 years or 10 years on that and deducting that interest. But that is the rule. You have to have equity to have that deduction on that second loan or that HELOC. The owner of the home has to be legally liable for the debt. And you can. These rules also apply to a second residence. The IRS says you can have two residences and deduct the interest on that. Now, you can't take $1 million on one property and $1 million on another one and take it all. It's $1 million is the cap between those two properties. We also get questions about points. Can you deduct the points? Yes, you can when you buy a home. You can deduct them all when you pay them. If you refinance that first mortgage replace with a better one with a much better interest rate, and you pay points on that loan, then you have to amortize it over the life of the loan. If it's a 30-year fixed mortgage, then you divide that $3,000 over the next 30 years, and you can add that to your Schedule A as a deduction. Now, on a rental property, it's a little bit different. You still have some restrictions that come into play, but you can buy a $20 million rental property, commercial or residential. I don't know if there's any $20 million residential. Maybe, well, multi-family ones like apartment buildings and so forth. You can deduct all the interest on that so long as it's using the acquisition of that property. You can refinance it. You can have a second on it, a second mortgage on that, and deduct that as well. You don't have any HELOC privileges there. Like my client borrowed the money on the rental property to buy their residence. That became personal interest. That's just interest that's not deductible anywhere on their tax return. It's just a deduction that is lost to them. So if you do go that route, you need to be careful and not sneak that on, because the IRS does find these sometimes, usually by dumb luck, actually, I think, than anything else, but they can find them. A rental property that is unavailable to be rented, let's say you've got a residential property and you're going to do some major work on it, so you're not advertising it, you're not looking for someone to come in and rent that property, and it's going to take you 6 months or 8 months or something like that. You're going to be the general contractor. You've got a full-time job, so you know it's going to take you some time. Well, you're still going to be paying the mortgage on that, and the interest on that, it has changed its nature. So you no longer have a typical mortgage interest deduction on Schedule E, the rental schedule on your tax return. You now either have an investment interest expense, or maybe it's become a personal interest. It just depends on the circumstances of what you're going through on that property. Investment interest expense isn't too bad. You're allowed to offset investment interest income dollar for dollar. What you can't use, you use carried forward through the next year indefinitely until you have more interest income to offset it against. If it's personal interest, then it's just lost. It's not a deduction. You can deduct. Most of you probably know about the passive activity rules. If you are not a real estate professional, someone like me, if I had a rental property and I have $25,000 in losses, I can deduct that on that rental property. Included in those losses is going to be the mortgage interest, typically, repairs and maintenance, property taxes, and so forth. If you have several properties and you're accumulating all these and most of them are generating a tax loss, maybe they're cash positive but are a tax loss, the passive activity rules limit the amount of deduction you can take to $25,000. And if you can't use it, all is not lost. It can be rolled over into the future or carried forward, as we like to say, and can be deducted when you have passive activity income or when the property is sold or disposed of. Now, if you're rich, and by the definition of the IRS, you make over $100,000 as your adjusted gross income, that $25,000 deduction is slowly phased out. And by the time you hit $150,000, you don't deduct anything. And that's a real bummer for my clients, because they think they've got this great property. They said, hey, I've got some losses. I did a lot of repairs on it. I'm going to save some taxes. And we get to doing the return, and their income is over $150,000, and there's no deduction available to them. But again, it's carried forward. It can be used against future passive income, or it can be all used in the time that you sell that property. And that comes in very handy. If you have a large capital gain on that rental property, and you're looking at a $200,000 capital gain, well, if you've got passive activity losses of $100,000, we offset $200,000 with the $100,000, and now your gain is only $100,000. So that does work out well. Becky also asked me to talk a little bit about capital gains, and Kathy Bewinga did an excellent job on capital gains on rental and investment properties. So I'm going to touch just the one slide here on your residence. Code section 121, again, another great code number there that all of us should go home and read sometime. This is just for your personal residence. The rule is you must own and live in it 2 of the previous 5 years. And they don't have to be consecutive years. If you move away or you have 2 residences, you can move into the other one and then come back. But so long as you live in it and own it 2 of the previous 5 years, this is available to you. The exclusion is $500,000 for a married couple, $250,000 for a single taxpayer on the capital gain. Now, we don't see too much of this anymore as a lot of the values have come down. But this will be around for a while. I think it came into the code in 1997, and it saved taxpayers, you know, tons and tons in tax consequences. So the way that the capital gain is calculated is just as Kathy explained. You take the gross sales price. That's what the GSP stands for. I just made that up. Pretty proud of myself. You subtract the closing costs, and then you subtract from that the cost basis. And the cost basis is typically what you paid for it, and you could add to it if you added a $50,000 bathroom or kitchen remodel, that would add to your basis. And you subtract that from the gross sales price, and that will give you your gain or your loss. Now, sometimes I get people asking me, I said, okay, I lost money in my house. I lost $100,000. I want to write it off. On a personal residence, well, in anything that's personal in nature by the IRS, you do not get to deduct that. So unfortunately, if you have a loss on your rent, on your residence, it is a loss that is gone forever. Just as Kathy mentioned, the mortgage balance that is left on that property when you sell it has no factor in determining the capital gain. It only lets you know how much money you have left after you've sold the property, covered the cost, paid off the lender, and then what you've got left over to invest into another home, residence, or use for whatever reason that you have. There are provisions if you do not meet the 2 of the 5-year ownership or occupancy rules, unforeseen circumstances. The IRS doesn't really delineate those, but there are certain situations that have gone through the tax courts and says, you know, if a military kind of situation, you're deployed someplace else and you need to sell it, they will prorate that over the 2-year period and you will get some exclusion amount. In 2009, the last item here, there's this non-qualified use limitation. Taxpayers are smart. We're smarter than Congress because Congress sets up a rule and we find a way around it. So good for us. What was happening is people had rental properties and they realized that if they moved into that rental property for two of the previous 5 years, they could sell it as their residence and get out of that capital gain. So the IRS said, well, this isn't, or Congress actually, they write the law, said, well, we got to find some way around that. And so if you have any non-qualified use on that property, if you have a rental property that you convert to a residence, it will limit that exclusion amount. And there's a calculation that does that, so you might lose, say, 15 or 20% of that exclusion on the capital gain. Instead of excluding $100,000, maybe it's only $80,000. So those are some of the caveats and things you need to look out for. I'm sure you get these questions a lot. I do have some real estate professionals that are clients of mine, and I will get occasional email or phone call asking about their circumstances. And these are good things to know to help them make those important decisions when they're buying investment properties or residential properties. All right, that's all that I have. Becky, come right on back.
Thank you, Mike. I have a question for you. I think it applies to me, too, because I have an old rental property I've had for a long time. There is a rule, and I just don't know it, and I know you do. You don't have to quote the number, though. What happens if you had a rental property for, let's say, 27 years? I know that the depreciation drops down. Can you just really quick tell us what the...
after you sell it, what happens with the depreciation?
Well, as far as your write-off, doesn't your write-off amount cut down year after year
okay.
depreciation?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yes, on a residential rental property, when you buy that, you can depreciate the value of the building on that property. You've got land and you've got building. And the IRS says that you can, let's say it's a $250,000 property. Let's allocate $50,000 of that property to land, $200,000 to the building. You would depreciate or expense that property over 27 and a half years. So after 27 and a half years, this nice deduction of depreciation, for which you do not write out a check for, it's just it's a calculation done on the tax return, that will disappear. And all of a sudden, your income will bump up because that might be, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 a year or more depending on the property.
All right, thank you very much. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll return. When we get back, we're going to start talking about lease options and AITDs, and we're going to talk about assumptions and subject twos, and I think we're going to see a lot of this in the near future. Thank you.
Okay, we're back.
For those of you who are just joining us, welcome to the Power Is Now Online Radio, where we're conducting a live event here in the beautiful city of San Diego at the Mission Valley Resort. And our panel has just taken a break, and we're back at it now. And our host, our moderator, is Becky, and she's going to take it from here. Welcome back.
All right. Thank you. Welcome back, everyone. I'm going to bring up Susan Lamson now. We're going to start the discussion about the all-inclusive trust deeds, also known as wraparounds. Thank you very much, Susan. Here we go.
Thank you, Becky. My name is Susan Lamson. I'm an attorney with Kimball, Tyree, and St. John here in San Diego, and I've been practicing real estate law for over 25 years and specializing only in real estate-related transactions. Today, I'm going to talk about all-inclusive deeds of trust, which are also known as wraparound deeds of trust. And when I'm explaining this topic to you, I'm going to talk in terms of buyer and seller, just to make it a little bit more understandable, although there are actually three parties involved in a transaction such as this. An all-inclusive deed of trust consists of a senior loan, one that was made in the past, and a second loan that is being made by the buyer of the property. So we have a seller who got a first deed of trust when he bought the property, and then a buyer who comes along later on and gets a deed of trust that includes that first deed of trust and then a new deed of trust. And with the second loan, the seller is the lender. So let me give you an example. A seller owns property that he is selling for $100,000. He owes $60,000 on the first loan on the property, the loan that he got to purchase the property. And he is paying an interest rate of 8% on it. Then the buyer comes along to buy the property, puts $10,000 down, and gives the seller a promissory note for $90,000 with interest rate of 10%. Because the $90,000 loan includes the unpaid loan of $60,000, it's called an all-inclusive deed of trust. And the two deeds of trust are overlapping. It's not really as if there are two separate secured amounts. In this example of $60,000 and $90,000, it's really as if one is subsumed under the other, so that there's an overlap. So then the buyer makes payments under his loan for the $90,000, and then the seller continues to make payments on his first loan to his lender, who's typically an institutional lender. So in other words, it's a form of seller financing. What are the advantages to doing an all-inclusive deed of trust? For the buyer, there are a number of advantages. One is that typically he's going to pay a lower purchase price. He's going to have a lower interest rate than he otherwise would from an institutional lender, and typically he makes a lower down payment. He doesn't have the loan fees, he doesn't pay points, and typically doesn't pay the other expenses that you do when you have a regular institutional lender type loan. And I think more importantly, in today's market, it's going to be easier for a buyer/borrower to qualify for these loans because typically the seller won't go through the process that an institutional lender will to make sure that the buyer qualifies. The disadvantages to the buyer are that these are very tricky transactions. You have to be really careful in how you draft your documents. And we'll get into a little bit of that in a minute, but that's probably number one. And number two, the buyer may end up paying the higher interest rate on both of the loans. What are the advantages to the seller? Number one, the seller can actually, you know, make money and get a higher yield off of this. He's earning interest at the new higher rate. And let me stop myself right here. Initially, the all-inclusive deeds of trust came up in the early 80s when we were seeing exorbitantly high interest rates, you know, particularly during the Carter administration. A lot of people were paying interest rates of, say, 18, even 20% on their mortgages. And that's when they became popular. Now I think that they're coming into play more because of the economy and buyers having a harder time qualifying for loans, and also coupled with sellers increasing difficulty in selling their homes or other real estate. The other advantage to the seller is that he's got more control over the loan. He's got the buyer making the payments directly to him rather than to, say, a third-party lender. The disadvantages to the seller are just the same as they are in any situation in which the seller is making a loan. You know, you're going to have the risk of your borrower or buyer not being able to make the payments. But you do have the property as security, so you can always foreclose on it. So you just want to make sure that your foreclosure provisions in the note and the deed of trust are really clear, particularly the deed of trust. What are some of the issues with these instruments? As I just said, they're somewhat complicated, so you want to make sure they're carefully drafted, and they've got to dovetail with the original loan. You can't have conflicts between the original loan and the all-inclusive deed of trust. So you really need to have either an attorney or someone who's really experienced in this. You, as the buyer, you want to know if the seller is making the payments on the first loan, because if that seller isn't making the payments, then you could just be completely out of luck and you'd be subject to the foreclosure. So what you want to do as the buyer is to record what's called a request for notice of default, so that if the seller is not making payments to the lender on the first loan, then you actually receive a notice from that lender telling you that the loan has gone into default. And you want to make sure that you've got the right to cure that, so that if your seller is unable to make payments or otherwise perform under the original deed of trust, that you as the borrower, buyer, can step in and do that for the seller. And, of course, you'll want to get some sort of credit for doing that. Another big issue, and it's a big one, is the due on sale clause. Typically, loans have a due on sale clause, meaning if you sell the property or if you refinance it, it accelerates the amount that's owed. You're considered to be in default, and the lender can step in and say, okay, the entire amount of the loan is now due. So you want to carefully review the loan documents for that first deed of trust and make sure that they don't have a due on sale clause. Or if they do, perhaps you can try to work something out with the lender on the first. The other issue is whether usury laws apply. A lot of the sellers who do the all-inclusive deeds of trust charge interest that is can be quite high. And there's an argument that these types of loans are not subject to the usury laws. But to be safe, you probably don't want to go more than 10% on the loan, because for California, that's our usury cutoff. The other thing is the senior or first loan has to be smaller than the all-inclusive loan. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense and it doesn't work. Another big issue is with title companies. Both
acting as the title insurer and acting as the trustee. So you've all seen on your deed of trust, whether it's on your home or whether you deal with deeds of trust on a regular basis, that it's a three-party deal. You've got your borrower, your lender, and then the trustee. And the trustee is almost always a title company. And their job only comes into play if there's a foreclosure. And then they've got the responsibility of conducting the trustee sale. So the title companies have had an issue with these documents because it's just not always abundantly clear if your deed of trust isn't well drafted, what happens at the foreclosure, what kind of a credit bid is in place if there is a foreclosure, how much is the credit bid? Will the first deed of trust be paid out of the sales proceeds? Should the title company reconvey the property when the loan amounts become the same? In other words, when the first one is paid off. At any rate, the takeaway message from this is please have the title company look at it before you sign all the documents. Let me add to that, although Becky asked me to speak on this topic, I have to say that I have prepared one, I think, once in my entire career, and we just don't see them very often. Now, as I said before, they were popular in the early 80s when the interest rates were skyrocketing and people wanted to take advantage of pre-existing loans that had much lower interest rates. Now I think they may be starting to be used again more because it is harder for people to qualify for loans. And in this scenario, you can get your seller to provide the financing rather than having to go to an institutional lender. The other vehicles that I'm seeing more are the option to purchase and a lease. I'm doing a lot of leases that have that, or a right of first refusal. And Debbie's going to talk a little bit more about the option to purchase and a lease. I also have a client who wants to buy from his landlord an option to purchase just on its own. I'm seeing a lot of private investors out there. Shared ownership, where one party may, you know, live in the home or operate, if it's a commercial building, operate it and get most of the advantages of it, and then the investor just plays a really passive role. And I'm also seeing seller carryback, which this kind of is a form of. I believe everyone got the forms, but I'm not sure, and if you didn't, they did get them. Okay. And I'm not sure if anyone has any questions. If you do, feel free to call me or email me. Probably email is best, and my email is Susan, S-U-S-A-N, dot Lamson, L-A-M-S-O-N, at kts-law.com. Thanks very much. You have a question here.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
The seller in your example has a loan through an institution, through a lender.
Mm-hmm.
Would they ever be tempted to not disclose that they've gone through this transaction if there is that due upon sale?
Right, exactly. And I probably should have touched on that a little bit more. Of course, that happens all the time. And where, you know, because it is unlikely that you're going to be able to ask the lender whether they'll just consent to it and waive the due on sale. And by the way, if you do ask for that, do everything in writing, get their, you know, approval in writing and their promise not to foreclose. But yes, of course, a lot of people do go ahead and hope that they stay under the radar and don't get noticed by the lender. The problem with that is just the dire consequences of the lender being upset and then and going ahead and doing a foreclosure. And then your documents should address that. If you don't go the route of getting approval from the lender on the first, what happens if the lender calls the loan due? What are the party's responsibilities and obligations?
You were talking about the payment, when people make the payment. Would having a collection agent do that? I mean, what do they call them? Where you make the payment to the third party?
Like a third, neutral third party.
And then the third party makes the payment.
Oh, yeah, sure. So the question is, when the buyer is making the payments to the seller, is it, maybe your question is it a good idea perhaps to have a neutral third party receiving those payments? Yeah, it probably would be, because how much trust do you have in the seller? You know, and that's the problem for the buyer. What is their real security if the seller is just absconding with the money, you know, and not making the payments? So it's a difficult situation. I have to say that I don't know that I would ever recommend doing this unless it's the only thing that you've got available. So the question is, would I recommend using a pre-printed form for the promissory note and the deed of trust? And I would say no. If you do use that, then I would suggest attaching an addendum. And then just, again, you've got to make sure that the all-inclusive documents, that is the note and deed of trust, dovetail and are consistent with the first. Okay, how much would it cost to have an attorney review or prepare the documentation? It would probably be, I'd say $500 to $1,500, depending on the complexity and you really want to try to think everything through and make sure you've addressed all the issues. Okay, thanks again.
Okay, so I actually have a question as well. I wanted to find out, probably need to ask Mike Batson this. Who gets the tax write-off on an AITD? You've got...
I do. Well, the seller in that situation would continue to get the deduction. The real problem I see in it is the borrower, they have to secure that note to the property, and if it's not recorded, as I understand it, it's not considered secured, and so the buyer is not going to get the deduction either. So both parties might lose out on a deduction on that. But yeah, it has to be recorded. If it's not recorded, then they have some problems there.
Okay. And Susan, you said that there's a usury law, and percent is your safety zone.
Right.
Okay. Is that for all time, or is that just based on our current low interest rate? Is that going to go up as interest rates go up?
It's actually in the California Constitution.
Okay.
That 10% is whatever, the max that you can charge. But keep in mind, Becky, that there are a lot of exemptions to the usury laws.
Okay. All right. Great. And one other thing I wanted to ask, or maybe just make a statement about, I had read some things in the chat lines about homeowners insurance,
yeah,
because that can be a red flag on a situation where you're doing something like this, and suddenly the beneficiary changes.
Mm-hmm.
So what they had recommended, and I'm not an attorney, I'm not recommending it, just something I read that I thought was of interest, was they said have two separate homeowners policies, one for each of the borrowers,
mm-hmm,
and their lenders. So I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're going to bring Debbie Funderburk up now, and she's going to cover lease options with us. Thanks, Debbie.
Hi, I'm Debbie Funderburk with the Funderburk Company, and what I wanted to talk about today are the lease options, and basically the definition of a lease option is it's an agreement between and a landlord in which the renter signs a lease with an option to purchase the property. The option only binds the seller. The tenant has a choice to make a purchase or not. So typically the lease options are common among buyers who'd like to own a home but don't have enough money for the down payment and the closing costs. A lease option may also be attractive to tenants who are working to improve bad credit before approaching a lender. A lease option may be a way for the seller to move property in a slow market. The seller advantages include earning above market rent, retaining all the property income tax deductions during the lease option period, and attracting tenants who will care for the property as they owned it. Well, how do you structure a lease option? Well, number one, a lease option needs to be written down. I've had the unfortunate situation in representing bank-owned properties where I've gone to the door, knocked, someone has given the landlord $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, the land moved to Jamaica, and there's no record of the option. I highly recommend that, one, that the option, there's a form through California Association of Realtors called the option agreement, and that can be used in conjunction with a purchase agreement or with a lease. I recommend tying it to a purchase agreement over a lease because you are giving the buyer an option to purchase. The buyer should first qualify for the loan amount because ultimately you want to hope that they are able to purchase the property. You need to specify the amount of the payment and the terms. So this refers to the amount of money the person leasing the property, the lessee, will pay and how often he will pay. Most commonly it's in the form of a monthly payment. For example, they may specify that the lessee has to pay $500 per month, and generally the payment is slightly higher than the amount the lessee would pay if the contract was simply an option to lease instead of a lease with an option to buy. We need to specify the purchase price of the property if the option is exercised. In other words, are they buying? They're locking in the price on the property. So are they locking it in for $150,000, $200,000? That needs to be written down so later on down the line there's no question about what values we've agreed on. You need to list the duration. In other words, what date the option must be exercised. Or is this a 6-year term? Is it a 1-year term? Is it a 2-year term? There's no set rules. They can be structured any way that you want to put it together, but it needs to be written down so that we know the duration of it. Specify what happens if the option is exercised. And often what happens is if you have rent at $500 a month, or let's see something more appropriate for California. If the rent is, say, $2,000 a month, maybe a higher than market rent is charged of $2,500, with $500 a month being applied towards the purchase price when the option is exercised. Then you also need to specify what happens if the option is not exercised, what happens to those additional funds. So the pros and cons of the lease, let me go over some of that, which we kind of briefly touched on. For the buyer, there's very little cash up front that's required to get into the purchase. The monthly rent credit builds a down payment. They can try out the property before buying it, and it allows the buyer time to improve their credit scores. For the seller, it gives them above-market rent. It gives them a stronger demand from prospective buyers. It gives them top dollar option price. It can give them top quality tenants. If the seller can keep the tax deductions. And then if the contract stipulates a non-refundable earnest deposit and rent credit, and unless he doesn't exercise their option, the seller gets to keep the money. So then there's some precautions. If the agent, from a broker standpoint, they only collect a portion of the commission up front. So they may be working on a particular deal for 1, 2, 3 years and may not collect the balance of the commission if the option is never exercised. The tenant may decide not to exercise their option, and they may damage the property and default on the lease. Another precaution is if the tenant on both sides, if the tenant doesn't make the payments, then the seller may be in a situation where they have to evict the tenant. For the tenant, they have the situation if the landlord doesn't make the payments, then they may see themselves being in a foreclosure situation. So, you know, I think what that comes down to is it is probably best if you are going to do a lease option and there's going to be money, say $10,000, $20,000 put up so that you can lock in the price of a property, to consult an attorney, spend the time to sit down and make sure that both sides are covered, try to lessen any type of damages that might happen down the line. You know, as far as our options being exercised in today's market, you know, again, like Susan said with the AITD, I haven't seen a lease option for years and years and years. But I think we are going to see more options happening. For the landlord, by having somebody do a lease option, you're giving, there's new tenancy laws that apply, and it takes longer and longer to get a tenant to be moved from the property. And then I believe, and maybe Susan comment on this, that if you do a lease option and somebody gives you, say, $10,000, $20,000 towards the property, you're giving them some ownership involvement in the property, even though they haven't exercised the option. So maybe you want to answer that now.
Well, let me say this, that you could structure it that way so that the tenant who's making these additional payments is not just getting credit in the landlord's books, but also is acquiring an interest in the property. I have to say I've never seen that, but you could structure it that way.
Okay.
Although you'd have to continually be revising the interest. You know, it would be increasing on probably a monthly basis.
Right. Years ago when there was a, if it's right now when it's a seller's market, you don't see that many sellers offering a lease option because they're seeing multiple offers. As the market starts to change and it becomes more of a buyer's market, I think we'll also start to see more lease options being offered. And then another question is, where do you find lease options? Call Craigslist. If you see a property that you like, you can call the owner and ask them if it's something they'd consider. If you see for rent signs at the property that you'd ultimately like to purchase, but this time you can't afford, maybe there's something that you can present to that particular seller. You need to. It's my belief that you need to offer them something so that they are willing to consider a lease option.
Debbie, I had a couple of comments. One is that, and by the way, I don't do any residential. I just, you know, handle commercial real estate transactions. But what we always do when there's an option, we record something called a memorandum of option. And that way, if the owner of the property later on tries to sell the property to a third party, then during the escrow, they're going to find out that there's this option to purchase.
Yeah,
and that will typically stop the third party from proceeding with the transaction. And another issue I just wanted to bring up, Debbie, was that please keep in mind that if there's a pre-existing loan, you know, a loan that's senior to when the tenant is granted this option, that if there's a foreclosure, I think most attorneys would agree that that would wipe out the option. So you, if you're really smart and you're the tenant, you'd want to talk to the lender and get the lender to agree that the option survives the foreclosure and get that in writing.
Yeah, that's great information. Thank you.
Sure. Susan, can you elaborate a little bit? What kind of protections could a person who's in a lease option, who wants to make sure that the seller is making the payments, they've made a large down payment, what can they do to know that payments are being made on time by the seller?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's similar to what we were just talking about with the all-inclusive deed of trust. What you can do is request that a notice be delivered to you by the lender in the event there's a default by the owner-borrower.
All right, now we're going to bring up Sasha Fabalukas. He's going to address private money lending for us. Thank you.
My name is Sasha Fabalukas. You've seen my shiny head pop up a few times here. During this presentation, I'm not only hard money, private money, I'm also an IT expert only when it comes to PowerPoint and thumb drives. Today I'm going to be talking to you about private money, hard money. I'm sure you've heard the term a bunch of times, and you know the question is, what is it? And what I like to say is it the kind of money that you lose your kneecaps over? Maybe in the past, but not these days. Hard money is money that's secured by a hard asset. That's why it's called hard money. Usually these loans are pretty short term. They last anywhere from 6 months to 5 years. Usually these loans are higher interest, and the reason they're higher interest is because they're usually funded by private individuals. Private individuals want, you know, they want a little reward for putting their money out at risk. The great thing about them is that they're always fast to close, almost always. In my case, they're always fast to close. And I'm talking about anywhere from, you know, 3 days to 2 weeks. So it's a great alternative for an emergency case. So why is hard money popular these days? I'm sure you've heard, or I hope you've heard, you know, some people using hard money loans to close these transactions. And the reason why is because, you know, we have this, it's like a perfect storm of a few things. We have, number one, low home prices. Number two, we have limited funding for investors. And that's the majority of my clients are people, are investors, real estate investors, people that buy properties as rentals, but the majority of which are people that are buying properties to flip them. And by flip, I mean actually do the work and resell them, not just resell them and double escrow. We also have a really interesting time because we have incredibly low interest rates, but it's really hard to get financing. So it's kind of like dangling a carrot. The only people that are able to get that financing are people that are buying owner-occupied, and usually it's you know, FHA or VA or some sort of government program that's allowing them to finance so low. And also we have this great opportunity right now, or rather investors do, to buy distressed houses. And, you know, I know I'm talking to a lot of realtors, and I'm sure you see these guys all the time. They're buying houses, they're trying to buy distressed assets, short sales, REOs, and so on and so forth. And the question is, you know, where do they get the money? Where do they get the money to? Here in San Diego, you know, you're getting, you know, 10 cash offers on every distressed asset, 20, 30 sometimes, depending on what's happening in the market. And, you know, it's really, they're not really cash offers. They're hard money offers. And the question is, who borrows? Who borrows at these high interest rates for these short terms? Usually it's pretty well-seasoned investors. It's not their first time at the rodeo. You know, they're buying 10 to 20 to 30 to 40 to 100 houses per year to fix and flip. The interest rates that they pay, they consider it as part of doing business. They know that this is going to be what their markup is. They know that this is how much money they're going to make on the deal. So they say, okay, I'm going to factor in that I'm going to pay this guy, you know, X percent on my money. I'm going to give you an example of a perfect client that would use hard money, and hard money was a very viable option for a lot of people because you could do hard a hard money loan on your home. In fact, that was the majority of our business before 2009 was owner-occupied second loans, people that just needed some cash to do this or do that. In 2009, the government really cracked down on that. So now we are pretty much not able to do owner-occupied financing. So the question is, you know, who's it really good for, and where can I use it? Where can you use it as realtors? And I want to, you know, give this example of this is Mike here. This isn't the real Mike. There's a real Mike. The real Mike is not nearly this good-looking, not to say that this guy is very good-looking. So I wanted to spare you guys. But Mike is a contractor, and he saved up $170,000, you know, working on other projects. And Mike decided that he's tired of working for other people. He wants to work on his own deals. So Mike was telling me this story, and he said, "Sasha, I found this house, this beautiful house in Encanto. I really want to spruce it up and resell it, and I think it's a good deal. And I can buy it for $165,000, and I can put $20,000 of work into it, and, you know, I can sell it for $240,000. And I said, okay, you know, but you only have $170,000. Well, I could borrow, you know, some money from my grandma or so on and so forth. And I said, listen, you have two options. Your option number one is to buy it for cash, do the work, put the property on the market, and then move on to the next one. Or your option number two is you can go to a hard money lender and finance this property and finance 80% of this purchase. And while you do that, you can go out and find two other properties just like this one and do the same thing. So the numbers kind of go like this. You know, he's buying it for $165,000. He's pulling out 80%, which is $132,000. His total cost for the loan after escrow fees and points and interest for the 3 months is about $8,000. So his net is $30,000 instead of $38,000. And even though the financing cost him, you know, 15% plus points plus escrow fees plus everything, he still made a really great return on his $53,000 invested. He made a 57% return, which is that $30,000. And Mike actually did that. He bought this house right here, and he bought two other houses within the next 2 weeks, and he turned them into these. This is the after product. How do you write in hard money financing into your deal? There's a couple different ways that I see a lot of people doing it. Number one is you can on traditional sales. I see a lot of people saying that they're going to put a cash offer, and they have a cash offer, and then at the last moment, they'll switch it out and they'll say, okay, we have a hard money offer and, you know, so on and so forth. The reality is it's just as good as cash because it's a quick closing. And that's what really people are afraid of. With a traditional sale or a probate sale or somebody where you're talking to a human being, it's pretty easy to explain that. And, you know, you don't really have any problems converting that, you know, cash offer into a finance offer as long as it's a hard money. With a short sale, you really have to jump through some hoops. It's pretty hard because you have somebody behind the cloak who has to approve it with somebody else, but I've seen it happen. And then with REOs, it's a little bit easier because you have one asset manager to deal with. Or the best way to do it really is to write it in as a hard money finance offer and be truthful because, you know, in our business, we have a fiduciary responsibility to be truthful to everybody. Now, traditionally with hard money loans, you're talking about there's different lenders out there in different types of loans. On the short-term loans, you can expect, they're kind of the same all across the board, 12% interest in 4 points, which is pretty hefty if you think about it, because right now you can go to a bank and get financed 3.5% for 30 years. The problem is nobody can qualify for that. Hard money can vary 10% in 4 points, 12% in 4 points, and so on and so forth. And I created a little bit of a different model. My company will go to 80% on the purchase price. We charge 15% and 1.5 points. There's no prepayment penalty. And I say the closing is 1 to 2 weeks, but the reality is we can close a lot faster than that. I just closed a deal in 3 days. And it's a really, really great option for people that are trying to do something creative. And I'll give you another story that I didn't put into PowerPoint. This is a story that just happened. This guy came to me and he said, "Listen, I have this property. It's a 3,300 square foot commercial building. I have a first on it, and you know, I had tenants in there and they moved out and they left the place a mess, and I don't have any money. But my nephew is a police officer, and he has a private security company that he wants that he already has going. He runs it out of his house, but you know, I'd like to rent this space to him and have him run the business, and maybe I can make some money out of it." And so what we did was we created a second loan for him, and the second loan went behind his first. That loan has a fund control that'll control all of the construction of this property. So we're going to fix up the bottom and then fix up the apartments on top of the building. It's a mixed-use building. And then once it's done and it's rented out, we're holding a six-month reserve. So for all the payments for the first and the second, once it's rented out and producing an income, he's able to go out and refinance it conventionally. And that's something that hard money allows you to do, is create that bridge. Although it's not cheap, make it happen rather than losing this place because didn't have any income or the property was, you know, basically abandoned. Does anybody have any questions?
Gina said, "I always have questions." She should know that better than anybody. Sasha, what happens in a situation? Kathy Bywinga, the 1031 exchange specialist, was saying that you can do a delayed exchange where you buy your property now that you're going to invest in and sell your current investment property later. Obviously, that could cause some qualification issues for institutional lenders. Is there any kind of bridge loan or something that private money could handle in a situation for an investor like that?
I don't really see any reason why that wouldn't that wouldn't qualify just because, you know, you have, what you're doing is you're buying one property and then you're buying another one, then you're selling the original one to create that exchange. And whether you get leverage or not, doesn't, I don't think it really makes a big difference, you know, to the exchange.
Okay, and last but not least, we're going to have Gina Ingolstadt. I think she's going to stay in her seat. Is that right? Twinkle Toes over there had a little accident and has an injury, so I'm not going to make her stand over here. Again, because she's my boss.
Wow. I had no idea I had that much clout and pull. I began my escrow career in 1979, and I have to say that looking back on it, it really was kind of a cool time to be in escrow. Interest rates were 18%. It was just great. Sure that escrow officers were the core of the transaction. And my boss would say, really, we're not going to do it that way. This is the way we think we should do it, the right way. So I just remember that. And escrow people were just a little bit more in control, which it was nice then. But anyway, I'm a little bit different today. But I want to say that my first escrows was today. I did San Diego Teacher Credit Union loans where we had two notes and one deed of trust. And it was just, we did AITDs, we did assumptions and subject twos and all those things. And so it really was a good basis for today, looking back. And if you can survive today, you can survive then. You know what I'm saying? That's what I tell my girls all the time in my office. So I want to say that when we're talking about subject twos and assumptions, I never considered it something that was like long term. You know, that it wasn't like you were going to do it and keep and assume a loan and do it for 30, 20 years or something like that. As a matter of fact, when I bought my house in El Cajon area, we did not assume the loan. We did a subject two because we couldn't get financing because the house had no furnace. Now, you may say, why did we buy this house? I still don't know today, but we still live there, and it's still under construction. But in any case, so when we're talking about an assumption, you would actually go to the lender, and you would say, dear lender, I want to take over the loan on the existing terms, and the lender would say, you are great, you're the best buyer ever, yes, we're going to let you do it. And what would normally happen is you pay an assumption fee, which could be 1%, you know, or just $1,000, something like that. The lender would run credit. And in those days, it wasn't like, you know, today. You could breathe and fog a mirror a little bit and it would be okay. It wasn't quite as stringent as today. And they would sometimes would record a, I can't even think of the word of it. Susan might know a little bit, but they would record something like there was an approval of the assumption. I can't think of the word of it today. And just to show that you did assume that loan formally. And that was really the nice blue sky world. But what really happened is the majority of the time when we did the subject to transaction, which means you're just taking title to the property subject to that existing loan. You didn't get that existing lender's approval to have to transfer the property. And we talked a little bit today about a due on sale clause. And I assume most of us are familiar with what that means. It kind of, it says if any or all of the property is sold, then, or transferred, without the lender's prior written consent, the lender would require immediate payment in full of all the sums secured. Now, I just pulled three sets of loan docs that we had in our office this week to see if those loans were assumable. Just because, you know, I have to check these things. And when I looked at the regulation, the disclosure documents, it says may not assume someone buying the assume the remainder of your loan on the original terms. So that kind of says to me that they're not saying no, but they're not saying that a new buyer maybe could come in and assume it at 3.25% or whatever the interest rate is on that note. So I did try to call a couple of lenders to ask them about assuming. And it's different language now because they're all in short sale, REO, distress world. So they're thinking about it, and they're going to call me back. So if I ever hear back from them, I will let you know. But so I just wanted to kind of find that out. So what would happen is if someone would come and they would say, we're going to buy the property, we're just going to take over that existing loan, kind of like I did in 1987, I think that's when I did it, and we just assumed the existing balance of that loan. and or excuse me, took title subject to that loan. And what would happen is the owner of the property would have the escrow holder what's called an offset statement to show what the payments were, what the balance was, and all those kind of things. Well, in the 80s, it was a little bit more cumbersome because, you know, we couldn't go on the Internet and just, like, you know, click the button and print a statement, or we couldn't do it on the phone like we do today when we call. So you had to have proof. You had to have bank statements, you know, to see what the real balance was. So as escrow, we had those forms. The seller filled them out. The buyer looked at them. And one of the things that was most important in our office, and I think to, is that the new buyer should get copies of those existing documents, existing note and deed of trust. Because in those days, you had all kinds of loans, a negative amortization, and we had those FHA 245 loans. Does anyone remember that? Yes, Becky, I knew it. So when the principal balance went up, right? So it was really important that you pay attention to that. And the same thing today. You know, you need to know if there's, you know, adjustable rates or anything like that. So you would have to get those things, and you would give it to escrow. And of course, you know, how are they going to pay? You know, the down payment. Is there going to be a down payment? Things like that. So we ask all those questions. One of the main concerns, whether you're doing a subject to or an assumption, is insurance. That's always a big deal because. Copy of insurance policy. So it's a big red flag if a lender gets insurance policy with another person's name. Okay, so this is kind of the problem. There were a couple ways to do that. One is adding the buyer's name to the policy, and the other was, as Jesse talked about, when we were talking about AITDs, where you would get two policies, the seller would keep the fire policy, and of course the buyer would pay him back, and the buyer would get like a contest coverage. Now, I haven't seen a lot of subject to's or assumptions in the last few years, but I can tell you that we have been getting more phone calls about it. And I think it's because financing is a little bit more challenging. And again, in my past, when I look back on it and I ask my staff about it, we didn't really see it as permanent financing. We saw it as a temporary fix, like it was be able to live in the house, to, you know, so you could get the financing that you needed. You know, you could, in a year or so, do what you had to do. But there is always that risk that the lender is going to find out and call that loan. So you're going to have to be prepared to do what you have to do, either get the financing or negotiate with them in some way. The other thing is we always thought it was a good idea to have a collection agent, you know, make the payments. And we were talking about AITD, so in other words, you pay it to a third party, and that party makes the payment. Because really, the seller's name is still on that deed of trust. That document's always recorded, right? So the seller's name is always on there. And I don't know if we have any new lender friends here, but in the past, you know, there was FHA and VA loans where someone used their eligibility to buy, VA eligibility to buy a house. Well, if that loan is still out there with another person making payments, sometimes they couldn't reuse their eligibility to buy another VA house. Now, that may be a little bit different today, but it might be something that you might want to consider since we are doing so many more government loans today than we did, you know, 5 years ago. And the other thing is we talked a little bit about, you know, who gets to deduct the interest. You know, because really the lender is going to be recording the seller's interest with his social security number. So that's kind of a little issue, too. And you know, an AITD, it might be a little bit different because the buyer's paying interest on the AITD, the seller's paying interest on the underlying loan. But on this kind of deal, it's not quite the same, which is why I don't think that it's what you would think of as permanent kind of financing. And in my experience, it wasn't. Let's see what else. And it was so exciting because I got to look at escrow instructions from 1980, and I'm telling you, those women were incredibly brilliant, the things that we typed up. And we actually typed. If you were going to do this subject to or assumption, I think the main important thing is disclosure. As we do everything else, you just need to disclose everything. Make sure everybody knows the potential risk. I know for a fact that in our escrow instructions we have like lots of disclosures about those kind of things. You know, if you know there's alternative financing, if you're an agent and you take the listing, you need to make sure and get copies of that note deed of trust, because everyone's going to want to see that, that underlying, those underlying documents. The other thing are the impounds for taxes and insurance. You need to kind of pay attention to that, because if the buyer is going to be making the payments, that money that's in the impound account is going to eventually be there. So is the buyer going to reimburse the seller for the money that's in that impound account? That's something that you need to talk about, and you need to kind of clarify it and probably have the seller sign something that he's assigning that interest to the buyer in case there's any problems with that. The other thing is, what happens if the unpaid balance, if they open the escrow and they tell you that the sales price, the loan amount is $300,000 and it really is $299,000, how are you going to adjust that? Are you going to adjust it to cash? Is the buyer going to bring in additional cash? Sometimes what we have done is we adjusted the sales price, so the cash can always stay the same. So if your buyer only has a certain amount of cash, you can adjust the sales price and it's, you know, still the same thing. I recently read an article from First Tuesday. You guys can go online, and it talks a little bit about the lawsuit with Wellcamp versus Bank of America, and they were talking about all these subjects too, and could the lender really foreclose on properties and do these land sale things? And I think it's kind of an important history lesson. If you're going to do that type of transaction, go kind of look at it and see what the court said about it, because it kind of changed the way people did those transactions in the early 80s. The other thing that I think is really important, you need to go and talk to and do an escrow or do the transaction with somebody that actually knows what you're talking about. You know, we have a lot of really great escrow officers in the last 10, 15, 20 years, but they might not necessarily have the expertise to know how to do an AICD escrow or how to do a seller sale that or how to do things like that. But I have to say that we've been getting lots of phone calls about it, so I think that this is something that maybe people are thinking about a little bit. So, I think that's it for me. Thank you.
All right. Well, I want to thank all of our panelists today and our sponsors. Really appreciate this great information. I knew it would be, and I'm excited to have this shared with so many people.
Thank you, Debbie. You did a fantastic job moderating the event today. And thank you, Shelley Kay, for inviting the Power Is Now online radio to be a part of this wonderful event. Folks, we have been live on the radio broadcasting this great information, and we appreciate so much our sponsors who made it possible today. We also appreciate the guests who brought some incredible information that I'm certain all of us can use as real estate professionals. I want to encourage you to reach out to Shelley Kay, and if you're not a member already of WINS, please consider becoming a member of this great organization. WINS is constantly striving to bring information and business opportunities through seminars, through webinars, and also at the national conferences. In fact, they will be at Five Star, so look out for them there. And again, reach out to WINS and let them know, especially if you've listened to this program today via the online radio program, please let Shelley Kay know and other WINS members. In fact, this show will be replaying every day next week. Every day next week, look on thepowerisnow.com under Real Estate Resource, and you'll find the WINS seminar also here on blogtalkradio.com/thepowerisnow. I want to thank again Shelley Kay for allowing The Power Is Now to broadcast this event. We certainly hope this is not the last. It is the first. And we certainly hope that all the WINS members who are listening to this show online will let Shelley Kay and others know about it. Please pass it on to your fellow real estate agents so they too can benefit from this great information. And again, I want to encourage you to listen in on The Power Is Now every week, especially on Thursdays. But there's information happening every single day. Next Thursday, Matt Martin with Matt Martin Real Estate will be on the line. If you want to learn about the opportunities at Matt Martin and what they're doing, tune in 10:30 Thursday morning Pacific Standard Time next week right here on The Power Is Now. Well, we are at our best, and we maximize our success when we act now. What have you learned today and what you can act on today? It has been a lot of information. Thank you for joining us today. Have an awesome day. See you soon. Next week, in fact, on The Power Is Now.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.